Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta.
I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today Dr. Timothy Gambin, not a new visitor on this program. He's, of course, senior lecturer in the Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University of Malta, where he specializes in maritime and underwater archaeology. So we're going to be talking about submerged archaeology. And this is because he is actually part of a COST project, which is called Splash COST. Welcome to the program, Dr. Gambin.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a particular project amongst many, I might say. Perhaps we can start off by explaining why this is a particularly an emerging discipline, the idea of submerged prehistory, and why it's become of particular interest now, and how you got involved in it as well.
When people discuss underwater archaeology, their thoughts first automatically turn to shipwrecks. There has been the exploration of a number of submerged sites, such as that of Bahia Sommersa, which is a Roman complex which is today underwater. But recently, over the past years, there has been an increasing interest in the exploration of submerged prehistory. And why prehistory and why submerged? Well, at the end of the last glacial maximum, which dates to around 15,000 BC, the ice caps start to melt. So the ice age is coming to an end, the ice caps are starting to melt, and this melted water is going down into the oceans and the seas and pushes up sea level. People that once lived on the sides of rivers or the ancient coastline are being faced with rising sea levels and are forced to move. There are a number of reasons why submerged prehistory has sort of increased, well, the interest in submerged prehistory has increased. And one of these is the instrumentation available to the archaeologist, the sonars and other instruments that are available to the archaeologists are now of such a quality that they can start to look for submerged sites, but also submerged landscapes, because we're looking at not only specific sites, so I don't know, villages or caves, but also the landscapes within which these humans acted.
The first thing that comes to mind is the story of the fishermen that pick up the mammoth tusks in the North Sea between, say, Denmark and Britain. That wasn't using any particular instruments, but it's rather shallow at a certain point, and that showed that there were mammoths walking across that area not so long ago.
Absolutely, and this brings me to the second reason why there is an increase in interest. There is a lot of dredging activity in the North Sea, where they dredge for aggregates, which then are used in construction or land reclamation projects, etc. Now, over the past years, there has been an evolution in legislation whereby such works have to be monitored by qualified archaeologists. This is a sign that the seabed in the areas where dredging was being carried out was recognized as a potential archaeological site. So this increased monitoring led to the increased reporting of such tusks of mammoths or molars of mammoths as well, but also hundreds and hundreds of arrowheads too. Now, if somebody had to do a slightly in-depth search on the subject, they will realize that this is not as new as we are making it out to be today, because there is a particular English professor by the name of Nick Fleming, who has also worked here in Malta, Sicily, also, who for the past 4 decades has actually been sort of flying the flag of submerged sites on the continental shelf. And it's, I think, solely to his dedication and intellectual capacity that we are where we are today with regard to submerged landscapes.
How did he start off, though? Because presumably he didn't have that kind of technology available. Was it a diving issue? Or?
Absolutely. He studied nautical charts. He studied these curves, what we call the sea level change curves. So he would plot these sea level change curves against the water depths, and by sort of figuring out where what areas would have consisted of dry land and when these would have consisted of dry land, he was able to plot areas of potential habitation by prehistoric humans.
What about the archaeological potential? Okay, we know that there are finds, there's physical evidence, but what is actually of interest to the archaeologists? What is the archaeologist getting out of this new discipline?
There are a number of finds which are being made, especially in northern Europe, places like Denmark and the northern coast of Germany, whereby some unique sites are being identified and also excavated. In some cases, you can have some pretty spectacular finds, organic material which usually does not survive in the archaeological record, so things like a famous wooden paddle, you know, in order to paddle around the shallow waters. But in Germany, they've also identified entire villages. In the same way, in the Mediterranean, in the warmer waters of the Mediterranean, off the coast of Israel, they have identified a number of submerged prehistoric sites, which include wells and the foundation stones of huts, and as part of the Splash Cost project, a field school on the excavation and survey techniques of submerged prehistoric villages was carried out by Ehud Galili in Israel.
What about, for example, the fact that really we're dealing with climate change here? So this is a very topical issue for us. Can archaeology help to increase our knowledge about climate change, about human reaction to climate change?
Well, what we just discussed is sort of one of the first things that we can learn, the actual archaeology, the material evidence that sheds light on the human past of these specific people who lived in these specific places. But as you mentioned, this is a very topical issue, and what in fact we are studying is the human reaction to climate change. Except that this is a human reaction to climate change 15,000 years ago. So we can certainly learn whether, and they surely did, because if they were living on next to the sea, a stretch of coastline that was slowly being eroded, then we can, through the study of submerged prehistory, we can actually understand, or better understand, the reaction of these humans. So where did they move along the coast, did they move up to higher ground, did they change their habits, and did these habits contribute to the slowing down of coastal erosion, etc. I mean, not very dissimilar to what people are studying now with regard to today's human reaction to climate change.
And you were talking about Denmark. What other places are there in the northern part of Europe that come to mind that are examples of discoveries of that nature?
Well, there are, I mentioned Denmark and Germany in Northern Europe, Israel in the Mediterranean, but if one had to look at a map on which sites, submerged sites, have been plotted, there are dots everywhere. Yeah, Italy, Greece in the Mediterranean come to mind, and we believe that the countries that do not have any dots on their map, that's simply because people haven't been looking. One of the outcomes of this Splashkos project was the publication of an atlas whereby every country submitted a chapter which gives the current state of affairs with regard to submerged prehistory.
A snapshot.
So it's okay if you haven't started to look, but it's important to know that, you know, up until 2014, nobody has been carrying out such research. That is equally as important as giving a table with, I don't know, the 150 sites that may exist in another country. Why? Because if somebody, a PhD student, for example, or a scholar, wants to start studying the submerged prehistory of Malta or of southern France, then they will have a snapshot, as you quite rightly described it, of the state of affairs in that year. That way, they can, let's say, if this is happening in 3 years' time, they can say, let me explore what happened between 2014 and 2017, see if anything's happened, and if not, then I can plan according to what is published in that atlas.
And of course, if the country next door to you in the Mediterranean has lots of dots in the atlas, it may be, obviously it may not be, but it's pretty good indication that your country has the potential to have dots as well. It might be an encouragement for other countries to try and look for these sites.
In fact, many of my colleagues in the Splashkos project sort of did not want to believe that we do not yet have any dots around our map, you know, given our rich prehistory and our rich, very extremely rich late Neolithic period. They all seem to be very excited with regard to Malta's potential. There are a number of projects that had been carried out. Ruben Grimard, together with a French team in the 1990s, with a lot of foresight, had looked at many submerged caves around Malta, Gozo and Comino. And unfortunately, they established that at the time, they established that sort of these did not have the potential that they were looking for. Since then, there's been a new cave discovered off the northwestern coast of Malta. This cave is fully submerged in under seawater, but is full of stalactites. So this clearly shows that at some point the sea level was lower than it is today, and fresh water trickled down, enough fresh water trickled down to form these stalactites. It's literally like a submerged Ardalam, not as deep, but with some pretty spectacular stalactites. In no way am I inferring that there are the animal bones and the remains in this cave similar to the deposits found in Ardalam, but the fact that this one cave very close to our shore, in fact it's part of the cliff formation on the northwestern side of our island, points to the possibility of other caves further out at sea, which are today again submerged, which may have the same deposits as those in Ardalam. So the potential is certainly there.
What depths are we talking about from the start of your inquiry? How far down would one have to go to find evidence?
You know, it could be at any depth, really. For example, in Israel, they're found in 12 meters of water. Just 12 meters of water just off the coast. We know that between the stretch of what is today a stretch of sea, the channel between Malta and Sicily, there was a land bridge that existed, and so one has to imagine sort of the sea slowly creeping up and covering that land bridge. And there would have been no way that humans at the time would have known that the sea was going to continue to rise. So a change, a site migration would have taken place from the current place of habitation to what, in my opinion, would have been sort of the most convenient and safe next place of habitation. They wouldn't have said, the sea is going to continue to rise, so we need to move 40 miles away. If 3 miles is going to get us to high ground, probably the pace of the change of sea level was not as dramatic. It was not dramatic enough to take for them to take equally dramatic action. So there may be actually a series of sites, because when we speak about, you know, 15,000 BC to 10,000 BC, like that, in a matter of conversation, it doesn't sound like much. But from 15,000 to 10,000 BC is 5,000 years, and 5,000 years ago from today, we were in the late Neolithic. So that is 5,000 years is a long time for humans to evolve, etc.
With me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM is Dr. Timothy Gambin, and he's come to talk to us today about a COST project called Splash COST, which deals with submerged prehistory. It's a lovely idea, this idea that slowly but surely over those thousands of years, the people would have had to have adapted to the climate change, the evidence of climate change, and one might even have this series of movements, either up towards Sicily or perhaps up towards Malta. Are there plans to try and look for this kind of evidence, or is there a lot of money involved?
There are conceptual plans, let's put it that way, and Dr. Ruben Grima and myself have had a conversation once or twice about this, and I think that, and this is going to be a bit surprising, and I'm laying down the gauntlet here, the potential must first be looked at from a mathematical point of view. I think this is a great opportunity for somebody with a mathematical background to collaborate with somebody with an archaeological background. Why? Because the archaeologist can point out what ancient humans would search for. So did they want to live on the edge of valleys? Did they want to live on the coastline, etc., etc.? The data will give us the submerged landscape. But it is the mathematician that has to work out the probabilities. So, because, and I'll explain why before this sort of turns out to be something too abstract. It's very simple. The seabed is an extremely huge area. Just think that Malta, Gozo and Comino form 350 square kilometers. When you include our territorial waters and the extension, the exclusive economic zone, that area becomes 11,000 square kilometers. So it would be preposterous to think that we can go and search every square inch. So a mathematician can work out areas of probability. You give him or her the data, you say these are the areas, and through a series of I don't even know what they're called, but I know that it can be done, for, I don't know, probability projections, let's call it that, they can say, look, sort of, these are the best areas where you can look, because the probability factors, again, you know, with regard to the presence of valley and ancient river system, etc., are in these areas. Once you have these sort of areas of concentration or areas of potential that are concentrated within a given area, then you can start to determine the various technologies that you need to study them.
Talking about bringing in other people, COST itself is a networking opportunity. I know from talking to people who have been involved in COST that you don't get money from Europe for the actual research itself, but you do get money for the networking. How important has the networking been on this Splash COST project?
The networking has been quite literally amazing. One, for the quantity of people that one meets, literally meetings with dozens of persons, and the quality of people that one meets with regard to positions in the institutions that they come from, the institutions that they represent, not only universities but also institutions that are responsible for the management of cultural heritage, etc. And thirdly, for the backgrounds of these people, because you have people who are experts in the act, you know, I don't know, they're experts in human skulls, then you've got experts who in the field of offshore marine survey, people who are experts in sea level change. So one can draw, you know, if you pick up enough business cards, then you can build build up a network, and one can draw upon the experience of all these without having to reinvent the wheel. So much so that in the course of the various meetings that I attended, I befriended and developed a working relationship with some Italian scholars, especially from the University of Trieste, and throughout the conversations that we had in the course of the Splash COST meetings, we actually put together some funding. And here I'd like to thank Anton Michale from the Institute of Earth Systems, who believed in this project and put some money towards this research, whereby two Italian scientists, one who specializes in sea level change, the other one who specializes in marine geology, actually came down to Gozo, and we carried out the GeoSwim 2 project. The GeoSwim 2, and I must mention it here because it is a kind of offshoot and a spin-off, yes, that's the right word, of Splash COST, as we snorkeled round both Gozo and Comino, pushing a raft that had a number of instruments attached to it, and we literally surveyed every inch of the two coasts, looking for things like wave notches that are indicators of sea level change, submerged wave notches, going into every single cave, giving them a number, and so on. And it's GeoSwim 2 because the first similar project was carried out in the Adriatic. This one was carried out in Gozo and Comino. We're seeing whether we can bring them down to do at least part of Malta. And as we speak, we're currently working on the academic publication of this research project.
In fact, I was going to ask you about the methods and technologies, because I was looking at the website of Splash COST, and the list of methods and technologies is quite long, and you've just mentioned this, you know, it sounds sort of quite hands-on, swimming behind this raft with the machinery on it, with the instruments on it. What are the things available to archaeologists such as yourself?
Well, there's a big debate on this, and there was a big debate within Splash COST, because on the one hand you have these experts in remote sensing and something like a multibeam, which will give you these fantastic images of submerged landscapes, and they are extremely useful, extremely colourful georeferenced images. On the other, you have people like my Israeli colleague Ehud Galili, who I send my regards from here, who believes that a simple snorkel and mask and a set of flippers, not even a scuba gear, is enough to discover underwater sites. So you literally have I wouldn't even say two schools of thought, but many schools of thought. What is certain is that there is a lot of overlap. I come from a background. My well, it's not speciality, but I do focus on searching for and mapping ancient shipwrecks. And there is a certain methodology that I use and a certain set of instrumentation that I use, which can also be used for the discovery of submerged landscapes. Likewise, people working in the field of submerged landscapes can use their methodologies and their instrumentation to discover ancient shipwrecks. Now, I was hoping and working to try and get people round the table and to discuss parameters within which, you know, each of the different disciplines or each of the different specialities can be satisfied. Unfortunately, this has not happened as yet, and we are still dependent on sort of individual collaborations and saying, look, I've got this data set, it may interest you, etc. But it's something that there were so many good things to come out of SplashCos that it's something that I decided not to shelf, but to continue working for in the future. I should also mention, in the context of methodologies and instrumentation, the university obtained funds from SplashCos to organize a field school in Malta, whereby we had a number of early stage researchers, participants, and a number of top scientists, one of who is Piedra from the CNRS, who are developing some of the latest technologies with regard to site recording. We were here for 7 days, there was the practical element of the school, whereby we dived on a number of sites, and then there were the class-based there was the class-based element of the school, and then we also obviously had the site visits to our late Neolithic sites and so on. So that was again a big feather in the cap of the University of Malta.
Before we end, I'd like to first of all mention that anybody who's interested in this project can go on splashcos.org, www.splashcos.org, and have a look at the project, and it has some very interesting information for everybody. I'd also like to mention Dr. Janet Mifsud, who is the national contact point for COST in Malta. If anybody's interested in COST as such, they can contact her on janet.mifsud@um.edu.mt. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time, Dr. Gambin. Thank you very, very much for coming to talk to us about this fascinating project, the Splash COST project. Thank you.
Thanks again for having me.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.